Hi, this is Leonard Peikoff here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. My responses cover subjects of general interest, such as human relationships, career, and morality, but not current politics. For the present, my answers are posted every other week on Mondays, and Dr. Yaron Brook answers questions on current events on the alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes on my website. Several years of podcasts are now easily searchable by topic or keywords. If you have a philosophical question to ask, simply go to www.peikoff.com, and that's spelled P as in Peter, E-I-K-O-F-F, like the word off at the end, peikoff.com. And of course, feel free to follow me on Facebook and Twitter. I am in love with a man and he loves me. We are in a long distance relationship. Recently, he told me he was looking at other people who he isn't attracted to because when he sees these other people, he wants to feel praised, which is what they give him, what she gives him, as he would be if I were with him. I know with certainty that I can move to him within 5 months. I've tried to explain to him that that wouldn't be praise at all coming from people that he's not attracted to, but rather he would be sanctioning the idea that he deserves less than he really does. I've explained to him, that's still the question, I've explained to him what he would get out of these people is not the celebration of his life that he desires, but a degradation of it. Have I made a mistake in my evaluation of this issue? What advice would you give him? Well, before I would give him advice, I would give you some advice. In the light of just the information you gave me, and assuming it's correct, do you think that he has the same code of values that you do? Do you think when you look at this behavior, somebody who claims to love you, but he needs a continual praise of what a great man he is, what a great sexual partner he is, so he wants to go with other people that he doesn't like and is not attracted to him, because they will praise him. Does that sound to you like a character out of The Fountainhead who places approval, praise above values? That is Peter Keating, exactly the way he was drawn. So you have to look at this man and ask, is this the only example you have in your whole history with him in which he has placed the feelings of others, which he doesn't like, above his own desires, and then try to make the pretense that that would satisfy him? You must have seen other examples where he wants something and he rewrites reality, regardless of what it is. You have given, to me, perfectly good arguments to him. But obviously, they don't make a difference to him because you're telling him what he should want to be in touch with reality. And he wants the praise, judging by your statement, more than being in touch with reality. So the advice I would give you is to think again, look again, decide who this person is. If you decide, yes, I love him so much that I'll love just the part of him I like, and not the rest, and if you can keep it segregated, you don't have to evade the rest, you don't come into the blue room when he's there or whatever, you can try it out. I don't think that's wrong, but if you find he's got really bad things, I'm going to separate them in my mind, except Tuesdays and Fridays and Saturday when we go to bed, then you are going to evade, and it's not going to end up where you want. My analysis is, I am not omniscient, and I'm not a psychologist, but my analysis is you and he are not going to work out together. I'm sorry, I might be wrong, but you seem to hold ideas and find them important, which he doesn't. He seems to hold the opposite and find that more important. Now, here's another Really agonizing question. I mean, I know what I would do, but it's a difficult question. It starts, I'm falling in love. Now, that's key to this question. The only way I can answer this question is if it were asked, I am in love. But falling in love, I don't know what that means. I mean, you see some good things and you want to hug him, or I mean, you've gone to bed and it was nice, or has this person reached the stage of an irreplaceable value in your life? That's what would be love in this context. And I'm assuming that's what it is, because if it's just falling in love, nobody can tell you. You wanted me to know, to tell you, should I go ahead and fall all the way? That is not up to you. If you continue seeing him and you have the values you have and he does, you have to fall unless you find out something to the contrary. So I'm only answering on the assumption that you do love the man. And this is therefore your dilemma. I'm quoting back in the question. He has an incurable fatal genetic disease. He is perfectly healthy at the moment, but will start to lose control of his body and ability to think starting anywhere between ages 30 and 50. We are both in our mid-20s. Once the symptoms begin, death typically happens within 5 to 10 years. So as far as I can figure out, there's between 5 and 25 years where he's normal, if I read this correctly, and then comes the decay. He could be my soulmate. What do I do? Should I abandon him and look for someone else, or take the chance of being with someone who could start mentally and physically deteriorating, since he could start mentally deteriorating as soon as 10 years' time? You know, this depends on your hierarchy. Philosophy can have no answer to when is a person, how long you have with a person at that point you should leave. Or is you should walk away if he's going to die in 6 months, but not in 6 years. There's no philosophic answer to that. That's why I said the question depends on if you are really in love. And then speaking for myself, if it is really love, you would never let go. Even if, and I'm not saying this is objectivism, I said this would be my answer. Even if there's only 1 year left and after that he's whatever, that 1 year would be so crucial to me that if I said, well, I gotta go because you only have 1 year, wherever I went, and if I did find a woman, and I couldn't make it work because the feeling would be, I'm trying to tell myself that this is really the one, and I know that the other one is still alive there. I couldn't do it. You just couldn't do it. And as far as I see, you left a pretty large amount of time. Apparently, he's still possible to recover. And didn't you say you might have 10 positive years of joy? And then he dies, and let's say you guess you're going to have at least 3 years of grief. Well, then you have to decide, is it worth it? Is it worth being miserable that amount of time to being ecstatic the other amount of time? And that is up to you. How you survive grief, how fast you think you can snap back, because if you do find someone after he's dead, then you're not making a pretense. It's not as though, well, I've left him and I've really found the right one, but I know he's my real love. He will be gone then. So it'll be easier to find someone. It won't be easy. I mean, you have a horrible, horrible dilemma. So I'm not urging you. I'm simply telling you, you have to weigh your priorities and go with what is the strongest to you. I want to add this one thing. I would stay with him until the point which you describe as, quote, he loses the ability to think, unquote. After that point, in my opinion, he would no longer be someone that I would, it would be like a corpse that I love, but the person is gone. The body is there. And I'd want to be sure that the body was properly treated, but I wouldn't have an emotional attachment as I would to a live person. In that sense, I've been accused of being very cruel, and in a way I am. If someone I love dies or becomes mental to the point where they don't recognize me, that's what I take it to mean, lose the ability to think, then I don't see any purpose in me maintaining a relationship with them. They get nothing out of it, and I certainly get nothing out of it. And I actually followed this. My mother got dementia in her late 80s, went to a home. She was a couple of years, she died in her early 90s. And at first I went to, it was another city, so it was a trip. At first I went to see her more or less regularly. And then at a certain point, she did not nod, she did not recognize me. She stopped speaking, and the only thing that she did was drink water from a straw. That's all I could see. And they told me at that point, she doesn't recognize anybody, she doesn't know where she is, so I drew the conclusion she's gone. The body is there, but the mother, the person I knew, the person I loved, has gone. And I never went again, except to the funeral. And I took some heat, you know, from the family, but I didn't see the point for either one of us. So in that way, I say to you, when he gets to the point that he doesn't know you, presumably your feeling will go. If you still want to stay, nothing wrong with that. That's the best I can do. If objectivism wins and takes over the culture, will it be irreversible? For instance, if Ayn Rand would have written her works in the 17th century instead of Kant, and Kant came around in 1957 and wrote his critique, his philosophy would have had no effect, right? Wrong. You cannot say any philosophy. Automatically, once it's there, once it's dominant, it takes over. We've seen that over and over. After Aristotle and the whole wonderful Greek civilization, the Middle Ages were all thrown out. And to this day, we had a wonderful politics of the founding fathers, and you see what we have. There are many mechanisms by which a philosophy can be overthrown. The people advocating it get sloppy. They're not that interested. They think it's automatic. There's always a silent minority or an uninfluential minority in every culture who resents what's going on but keeps silent because they have no support. But they may start to get some support from some people, and the establishment may start to lose some, and then there's some disaster, maybe caused by within the society or without, and it's blamed on the first faction, etc. And the end is the entrenched philosophy is overthrown, and rapidly, as I've given you examples. And the principle here is eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. That was Benjamin Franklin, I think, wasn't it? Anyway, 100% true. Objectivism takes over. The people involved in keeping it, the intellectuals, the teachers, and so on, if they are not eternally on the watch, it's going to be not too long before you won't even remember what objectivism was. A very brief one. How many pages of ink writing per day could Ayn Rand write when she was writing fluidly? I don't know. There were, of course, no computers in her day. She wrote in handwriting, and then she had a secretary type it up. And I, by the way, had the privilege of proofreading the final galleys of Atlas. And the publisher told her that they had never seen a book of that size error-free from beginning to end, which I always took as a big achievement. But that's just irrelevant boasting here. So I can't answer for her. But the next question is, how many ink pages per day would you typically write when writing fluidly? In other words, without squirms and confusions and so on. I'd say at the best, philosophy would be 3 days. Fiction, maybe 15, 18. But I write very fluidly, freely in fiction. One class, the teacher told me, this 15 pages is too long. Cut it to 8. And I sincerely tried to follow, and it turned out that they made the 15 into 60 pages. I thought, this has to be explained in this and this, so I just added a little bit. Just like my books, you know, start off as a brief summary of a lecture course and end up as hundreds of pages. So there's a big difference on what I'm writing. Let me hasten to say in conclusion that the speed has nothing to do with the value. You can write very slow, and it's awful. You can write very fast and it's good. This is only, you know, as a quantitative measure of nothing in particular. Thank you. If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peakoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.